Okay, well, let's get started then. Does everybody pretty much know everybody else?
No.
Or would it help if we just quickly went around the room since we're not that numerous to introduce or reintroduce ourselves? Art Simon here. I'm Executive Director of Bread for the World.
I'm David Mesmer. I'm teaching about Africa out here.
Steve Mars.
I'm Steve Christensen, I work with the Coast Guard as a civil engineer. I'm here as his guest.
Steve Masonbring, I live in Green Bay and I work for Procter & Gamble.
I'm Barb Stamp from Minnesota.
Karen Miller from D. Harvard.
Paul Swanson from Milwaukee, Oregon, suburb of Portland.
I'm Lou Gellerman from Vashon Island, Washington. I'm in business for myself as a management training consultant.
Bob Becker, Bremerton, Washington, school teacher.
Married 25 years in one day, right?
Yeah. Ruby Holmgren from Gladstone, Oregon.
Diane Griffin from Columbia, Maryland.
Jack Griffin from Columbia.
Beautiful.
Dutton Fuddy Gulen from CTAC, Oregon.
Okay, a few folks up here on the balcony.
I'm Dave Peterson, I just graduated from Pacific Lutheran.
Okay. I'm Kathy Masonring, I live in Southfield, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit.
I'm Alan Wilson, I live in Pentagon, British Columbia, and I'm an eye surgeon.
Okay. Did I miss anybody back here?
Me.
But I can't. Oh, yes.
I'm Ginny Nelson, and I'm from St. Paul, South Dakota.
Ginny and I are going to take today's and tomorrow afternoon sessions together. Today I'll take the lead, and Ginny will chip in or she has something to add or change or correct from what I said. And tomorrow we'll get to a more of a how-to session, what we can do in terms of local action, citizen mobilization. And because Ginny is our state coordinator in South Dakota, she's got lots of experience as a local person who knows how to make things move. So tomorrow she'll take the lead and I'll kind of sit next to her and maybe chip in now and then if I think of something to add. So, pardon? No, I didn't. Sorry. That makes it official. So what I'm going to do is kick it off with some comments of a very sketchy sort. It's really an outline for what ought to be a longer speech, but isn't going to be. And so once I get through this, then we'll just open it up and we can, you know, if you want to pick up on things I don't mention, that's fine. If you want to probe more deeply into one or several of the points that I bring up here, we can do that too. We'll just let it go whatever direction you'd prefer to take it. Hunger, the Hidden Holocaust. Kind of an intriguing title, one that Ginny came up with here and threw on the board. So initially I thought, well, I'm stuck with it, so I'll have to develop it. But I really liked it the more I thought about it. First thing that came to my mind was UNICEF statistics. UNICEF tells us that every month more than 1 million kids under the age of 5 die from hunger or hunger-related diseases. That's more than 1 million a month. Now if you think of the Holocaust with a capital H, it said that 6 million Jews perished during World War I. Now we're talking here about twice that many kids every year between the ages of, you know, 1 day and five years. So in effect, what we're witnessing is annually two Holocausts. Just taking kids, you know, 5 years old and under. Willy Brandt, the former Chancellor of West Germany, said a few years back in a UN address while he was still chancellor, and more recently he has written in report of an international Blue Ribbon Commission that he's headed, which has produced a report called North-South Program for Survival. Brant has said, morally, it makes no difference whether people are killed in war or die from hunger as a result of the negligence of others. And that's kind of interesting. You know, morally, he says these two things are equivalent. People getting killed in war, people dying of starvation due to human neglect. About a year or so ago, I saw what was really a rerun of a documentary on PBS television. Some of you probably saw it, a program called Return to Auschwitz, documentary about that particular concentration camp. Any of you see that? Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
Okay. I was fascinated by this particular documentary. It showed, featured a middle-aged, I think 57-year-old British woman who had been a survivor from Auschwitz. She had spent 2 years there as a teenager and had survived, now a British citizen. And she was, the cameras followed her around to different areas of that camp as she was talking with her son, who was a young physician. And he would ask her questions and she would comment. Near the end of the program, she was at one particular part of the camp where she had spent some time. She was describing how day after day, you know, hundreds of people had been marched by to their deaths. And her son asked her the question, well, didn't you know what was happening? And because of something she had said that triggered that question. And she said, well, we knew, and yet we didn't know. We made ourselves not know because to know was to not be able to continue. You couldn't go on living if you knew. So you made yourself not know. And then she said, it was only when we were suddenly confronted with an individual act of cruelty, such as a baby being torn from its mother's arms and thrown against the wall, that we suddenly were brought to a realization of what was going on. And when I heard that, I immediately thought how true that also is of the hunger issue. You know, the numbers are so massive, the problem is so big, so horrible, that we tend to screen it from our reality. We know, but we make ourselves not know, because to know means almost not being able to go on. And it often is when we are confronted with, you know, some individual person or situation where that involves, you know, individuals suffering from hunger, that we suddenly begin to realize what that means. Okay, so much for the introduction, Hunger, the Hidden Holocaust. What I really want to do is run through a handful of causes of hunger and say a few things about some issues, at least, that can begin to respond to some of those causes. First cause, maybe I should say too, by way of commercial, Bread for the World through Paulus Press has recently put out a book called The Causes of Hunger. It was edited by one of the members of our board of directors, Father Bill Byron, who is the president of Catholic University, happens to be an economist by academic training. And anyway, it's got a whole bunch of chapters on various causes of hunger, including ones that I'm going to mention, plus a handful of others. One cause of hunger, and you have to say it's the overriding cause, is poverty. You know, basically people are hungry because they are very poor. It's true here in this country. It's true even more so in the developing countries where, you know, hunger and poverty are far more acute than they are here in the States. Somebody once said, I think it was Peter Drucker in one of his books, that poverty here in the States is what many people of the world aspire to. You think of a country like India. I'm not sure the statistics are right on target now, but I know a couple of years ago, roughly half of the Indian population was officially placed under the poverty line by the government. That, I think, would still apply. It would be almost half of the population. Do you know where they draw the poverty line? For an urban family, $9 a month. For a non-urban family, $8 a month in income. I mean, you're talking about very poor people. You're talking about, you know, extreme poverty. And where you have that kind of poverty, you more likely than not have people who are not adequately nourished. Now, the extent of their malnourishment may vary considerably from something quite extreme to something fairly marginal. But poverty is the cause of hunger. People are hungry because they are poor. They don't have, well, that really moves me into another area, lack of adequate resources. This is very much related to poverty, as are many of these other things I'll mention. You know, people either don't have the income or they don't have the land or the combination of the two that would enable them to be, you know, to either buy or produce enough food to feed themselves and their families adequately. Get on the whole question of food distribution if you want to, but the basic mechanism for food distribution is the free market. People have got to buy food in order to, or produce it for themselves in order to have it. Powerlessness is another cause of hunger. People who are extremely poor, people who are among the victims of malnutrition, are, you know, generally characterized by powerlessness, simply because they don't have, you know, they don't have the economic leverage, nor do they have the political leverage, the kind of political voice that would enable them to, you know, get themselves out of the kind of predicament that they find themselves in. So powerlessness is another cause of hunger. Unemployment and underemployment is a cause of hunger. And there are vast, you know, we think of unemployment as a problem in our country, and it is, you know, roughly 10% of the labor force unemployed. But that figure is very modest compared to the situation in most developing countries, where unemployment is rife and underemployment is even more common. And because they don't have unemployment compensation and systems of Social Security like we do here, the unemployment problem there is, of course, far more disastrous. International economic system with its inequities is another, you know, casting the net very broadly, another cause of hunger. And just to cite a few particulars there, the terms of trade for developing countries have been a problem over the decades. That is to say, the money they can earn from the things they produce and sell to you know, on the international market, compared to the what they have to pay for the things that they need to buy on the international market. And typically what's happened over the decades is that the, you know, the amount of let's say the amount of sugar or the amount of coffee that you have to produce in order to get, you know, X numbers of tractors has gone up and up, and the number of tractors you buy from them has gone down and down. The terms of trade have become adverse, and that's been made particularly acute since the energy crisis of about a decade ago, and more recently with a world recession. As a result of that, another thing you find characteristic of the international economic system today is the rapidly growing indebtedness of the developing countries. Their debts have simply soared over the last half dozen years or so, and now stand overall at something like $700 billion. And it's even the carrying costs, even the annual paying of interest on that kind of debt is an enormous drain on the developing countries. Okay. Another cause of hunger is, I've just mentioned the inequities of a couple examples of inequities in the international economic order, but the same could be applied within countries to varying degrees because you've got different situations in different countries, but you've got economic systems often that are very inequitable, where a relatively small number of people are extremely wealthy and get much of the income, and where a large number of people are extremely poor and have access to very little of the country's economic growth. Another cause of hunger is one that's been mentioned prominently here in a number of forums just since in the couple of days I've been here. That is spending on arms, where you've got an enormous amount of resources being poured into the arms race, to military spending. You obviously are being shorn of opportunities to put those kinds of resources into things that will, enable poor people to become a more viable part of a country's economy and work their way out of hunger. Food insecurity is another cause of hunger. And by food insecure, that could mean a lot of things, and it does, but basically what I mean by that is situation in which people are living so close to the edge that when drought comes along, or perhaps war, they're pushed over the brink. The thin line, the line of having food reserves to tide them over tight situations is very marginal. And so the whole question of food insecurity leaves many, many developing countries in a very precarious situation. Another cause of hunger is, and I'm lumping a bunch of things together here, lack of education, lack of technology, lack of management skills. Some of the fairly basic things that we tend to take for granted here in this country are in extremely short supply in many developing countries. Population growth rate is another cause of hunger. It's also a consequence of hunger, probably more a consequence than a cause. But it's probably a cause that's most frequently cited by people, and so typically Westerners will say, well, if they just keep having so many kids, they wouldn't be in this kind of a situation. And not much use sending food abroad or doing anything else until they come to grips with that problem. Well, that's a bit oversimplified, and we can go into that if you want a bit later in our discussion. It's not only a bit oversimplified, it's enormously oversimplified, and there are reasons why. It's not very effective simply to concentrate on the population growth rate in isolation from other factors. Another cause of hunger, which it really belongs in a category by itself, but I throw it in because I think it's enormously important, and that is lack of political will. It's been interesting that several presidential commissions just within the last decade have commented on hunger from different standpoints. President Ford had a commission in which he was asking the National Academy of Sciences, who in cooperation with 1,500 scientists across the country came out with a 6-volume report that basically was dealing with the question, what can we do with our technological capability here in the States to address the problem of hunger? And interestingly, the scientists, among their conclusions, said, well, we've got the technological capability, either in hand or visibly on the horizon, But what we lack is the political will. You know, they said if there is a political will in this country and abroad, we could overcome the worst features of hunger and malnutrition within a generation. More recently, President Carter appointed a commission to deal with world hunger, and that had a more, you know, more wide, broader agenda. It was not focused so much on technology, but again, you know, came to the same conclusion that the political will was a critical ingredient. Without that will, a lot of the things that we could do to eliminate hunger simply will not be done. So lack of political will is a key factor. All right, those are just some of the causes of hunger. They're, I think, some of the basic ones. They're not the only ones, for sure. Let me just quickly skim over a few things that I put under the solutions side of things. And just by way of introduction, let me say, overall, I think what has to happen to eliminate hunger is that the type of development needs to occur within countries which does a number of things simultaneously. You know, it needs to involve all of the people in the economic life of the country. And that means especially and particularly the very poor, because these tend to be the ones who are left out, who are marginalized. It should, in most cases, there are exceptions, such as Hong Kong and Singapore, in most cases, you know, it means that a country needs to focus especially on the agricultural sector. That's got to be the leading sector in the, you know, as you figure out how you're gonna shape the economic development of a country. And in the light of using agriculture as a leading sector, then figure out how a lot of other things will fit into that. Development has to occur with an emphasis on a labor-intensive approach rather than a capital-intensive approach. That is to say, developing countries, for the most part, have an oversupply of labor but a severe undersupply of capital. And there is no sense for countries in that position to, you know, emphasize approaches that are going to demand what they lack, capital, and overlook what they have an abundance of, namely labor. So a labor-intensive approach makes a lot of sense. In addition to that, it should stress self-reliance. You know, the aim is not to become more dependent on other countries, on aid, on countries like the United States. The aim is to become increasingly self-reliant in food production and in other areas. Along with that, you know, the development should be sustainable. That is to say, both in terms of technology, over the long pull, it has to be sustainable. Shouldn't get into the situation like Poland got into, where they borrowed heavily, poured money into some questionable industrial development projects, and suddenly found that they couldn't keep up with it. They were head over heels in debt. Well, the same kind of thing has happened too frequently with developing countries as well. So it should be sustainable in that sense, but also in the sense of taking into account the environment so that the kind of development that occurs is not destructive in the long pull of the environment, because you have got to have the environment on your side if you're going over the long pull to make it work. Now, what are some of the very specific issues that can help to address some of these causes of hunger? Well, let me say at the outset, we have to acknowledge the fact that what we can do here in the United States is very limited. Overwhelmingly, question of whether people in other countries are able to help reduce and, you know, gradually eliminate hunger and poverty is going to depend on their own efforts. That's what's happening now. That's what's going to happen in the future. We can't, you know, draw up a nice scheme and dump it on them and say, here's the way to do it, you know, and here's the money to do it, or here's the technology to do it with. The efforts, you know, the decisions all the hard work that's going to make it happen has got to come from people within the countries themselves. So what we can do is limited. We have to acknowledge our limitations and not think that you know, we as Americans are the people with all the answers and we'll very patronizingly hand those answers down to them. On the other hand, we've got to say that while what we can do is limited, what we can do is enormously significant. And we dare not play down the significance of what we can do. Well, what are some of the things we can do? Thinking of very specific issues, because that's what Bread for the World is into, within the whole area of aid, we can do a much better job of targeting our aid so that it is effective and has a direct benefit to people who are truly poor. We've been working on the targeted aid issue for a couple of years now. Currently, a piece of legislation that is in the aid authorization bill on the House side, and I think will be included in the Senate side too, and we expect action on that sometime early this fall probably, maybe in September, is legislation that does describe in much more acceptable way as far as we're concerned, because it's language that we helped draft, a provision that would require that our development assistance, that is U.S. bilateral development aid going to developing countries, that it primarily benefit people who fall below the World Bank's category of being absolutely poor or other similar definitions of poverty. And so this is one effort, one way in which we think that we can make a small but significant nudge in the right direction. What our aid does is limited, we have to acknowledge that, and yet what our aid does is significant, and it can, in addition to just the dollar amounts and the projects that it gets involved in, it can help to highlight an approach to development that will set a standard for other aid donors and for the recipient countries. Another example of an aid issue that can be significant is something that we're just developing, has not been announced yet, but will be announced in September, and that is an increase in humanitarian aid for particular agencies or projects that we think, or types of projects that we think have been especially promising in terms of their effective delivery to people who are extremely poor, such as the UNICEF effort, the International Fund for Agricultural Development. the U.S. Health account within the U.S. Agency for International Development, and probably some other things along the same line. We'd like to see that increased by approximately $250 million. And at the same time, we're planning to ask for a moratorium on increases in military spending. But military aid. Because over the past several years, military aid has gone up very rapidly. And there are a number of reasons why that's, we think, not healthy. Just to pick out one, most of that military aid goes in the form of loans. It isn't just military assistance given to countries, but it's military assistance that adds to the indebtedness of those countries and requires from them resources that are really urgently needed for much more basic stuff like eliminating hunger. So anyway, that's another example of the kind of thing that we can do on the aid issue. Again, admittedly modest and limited, but nevertheless, we think significant. Unemployment, as I mentioned, is a cause of hunger. We haven't come up with anything yet. We're in the process of developing that issue and preparing either to draft some legislation or to buy into some legislation that will address the unemployment issue here in the States. Bread for the World has, over the past few years, been concentrating primarily, when it comes to hunger in the States, on food aid programs. And I think that's defensible. I mean, it can be explained, it's defensible. I think we probably didn't have too much choice, but not very satisfactory, because there is a certain inconsistency. We've been saying, when it comes to the developing countries, what we need is an approach to development that stresses self-reliance and getting people employed and getting poor people involved in the economic life of their country. When it comes to hunger here in the States, we've talked about food stamps and child nutrition programs. And we would like to move much more into at least one or two or several key things that really begin to address the question, how can people be included in the economic life of our country? And how can that have an impact on the way resources are distributed, how income is distributed here in the States? I mention that also because it ties in with the next thing and the last example I'd like to use, and that is trade. Trade is a very important hunger issue. We think of it as something for the big companies, or maybe an issue that the economists like to pick up and talk about on the financial page of the New York Times. Not something that we know or care very much about, and certainly not something that seems to us to have much to do with hunger. But as a matter of fact, trade has a great deal more to do with hunger than does aid. By comparison, aid has been called the soft option in comparison with trade. The level of dollar flows are about 10 times as high on trade as they are on aid. And so what a country can do in terms of trade earnings is much more significant to those countries for the most part than is the amount of aid that they're receiving. People are hungry, we said, because they're poor. They're poor because they often don't have jobs. They don't have jobs because countries often aren't able to develop the kind of industries or employment opportunities that would give them jobs and enable them to work their way out of hunger. And they don't have those kinds of industries often because they don't have trade opportunities, market opportunities in countries like our own. And one of the reasons they don't have market opportunities here is that we've got unemployment problems of our own. So we've got built-in resistance to opening our markets more to those countries. Right now, the thrust is in the direction of protectionism, not freer trade. Well, one bill that's before Congress that probably is going to go through this year is the administration's Caribbean Basin Initiative, CBI for short. And that's going to include some aid, but it's also going to include some trade incentives, some incentives to private enterprise to get in and do some things that will enable those countries to do more trading here in the United States. Quite limited in a way, but we were worried about that when it was first proposed on several grounds, but primarily because we were afraid that the investment and trade incentives would encourage the production of more export crops in those countries, particularly livestock and sugar, and maybe have the impact of turning more productive land away from production of staple crops for the local population and into the production of stuff that would be sold here in the States or in other countries, and that the result would be not less but more malnutrition. So last year we drafted what we called a Land for Food Amendment that provided some safeguards against that kind of thing happening, against trade incentives having an impact of producing more malnutrition, of land being turned over to, you know, turned out of staple food production into export crop production. And this year, though it didn't pass last year, it did get through the House version, but the whole thing didn't pass. This year, the administration was willing, last year we fought the administration on it. This year, the administration was willing to go along with it and include it in the CBI legislation. It looks like it's going to go through. So that's just one little thing on the trade issue. Again, it's very limited, very modest, not going to change the world. But we think it's significant as at least one concrete step in the right direction.
Can I ask something right now?
Yeah.
What guarantee do you have when you write an amendment like that, that even if it's passed with that amendment intact, that they're going to enforce it?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the answer is no, intrinsically no guarantee. So there is always a job after something is legislated to monitor what happens. And assuring compliance on it often depends on the kind of interest there is in Congress and among the public on seeing to it that it is really enforced. Now, there is in this provision, I don't recall the particulars, but there is a requirement that this particular provision be reported on, that the administration report on it to Congress. And there are people in the Congress, we feel, who have shown enough interest in this particular provision so that, you know, we think there are going to be some...
Well, like when I get the Best of the World newsletter and it lists the Congress people and the way they vote, you know, I find that very helpful because you can then know who to target or who to contact if you feel like you want a true answer.
Right. Okay, we do have, in the case of the House last year, a vote on this, on the CBI, on our CBI amendment. And, of course, this year what's going to happen is you'll get a vote on the CBI, but not on this particular provision. So that may not tell us too much about their attitude on, you know, toward this thing. But we will be in the position of getting reports on what's happening and then being able to go back to the administration and two members of Congress saying, hey, if we think there are problems, you know, hey, look what's happening. This violates the law. Let's insist on that accountability.
So there is some accountability then?
There is provision for accountability, but the extent of that accountability still requires some watchdogging and some work. There's no automatic assurance that just because the law is passed, things are going to happen, yeah.
Because I think that's a very, because the vast amount of lands that people like McDonald's hamburger own, and the livestock that's growing, you know, that's fed and brought back to the United States from the land they've taken away from the people. The millions of acres of land that the people lost to our hamburgers is just kind of overpowering.
Let me, at this point, I've talked too long, and I apologize for that, but let me just give Jenny a chance here. Do you want to hop in and say?
Well, I think you've really dealt with it well. There were just some things that I thought of, but they might really come up in the questions that people have. The one thing that I think has been really insightful for me in studying in this issue is that one thing that you brought up, Art, about that we as a nation have conceived that we are, as far as when I talk to people, a generous nation of giving to people who are in need. And it wasn't until I really began to study the types of aid that we do give, and as you said, that most of them are loans and not very little of it is free gifts, but that in relation to the impact that changes in trade laws could have, as you said, would be so much more, much a larger impact than the small amount of aid. And also the provisions that our nation puts on so much of the aid, such as an example would be if a country buys grain from particularly perhaps a United States-based multinational, there's oftentimes provisions placed on that aid that they buy the products from that country. We are promoting to be in favor of free trade and free market, and yet with these provisions, we are in some ways, I feel, moving away from free trade as far as for those people, and locking them into things that would not perhaps let them get the best price for perhaps, like, let's say a tractor if they bought grain. Something that I would like to just show, because I think it's an interesting document. We're talking about possible solutions. Well, the Third World has drafted this document through the United Nations. It's called A Declaration on the Establishment of a New International Economic Order. And I have one copy of this. I could make more if someone would be interested in having a look at it. This is the copy from during the sixth special session in 1974. There have been further drafts of this, but it gives you an idea of what it is. And then this book called Bread and Justice, which the bookstore ran out of. I guess people have been buying it, which is encouraging. I've been recommending it all summer long. It's pretty much a critique and examination of the New International Economic Order by James McGinnis. And it basically lays out some of the things, particularly that the Third World and the developing nations are asking for as far as in changes in trade and tariff, and also explaining, as you were talking, the spiral of debt and why a lot of these nations are in the situation they are. And I would highly recommend this. And also something that you might be interested in reading, just from an aspect of the drought and poverty being one result of hunger. There was an article in a recent Time magazine, which maybe some of you read Time magazine, I don't know, but July 11th, 1983, and drought, death, and despair, and talking about the effects of the drought and five nations in particular, Ethiopia, South Africa, the Philippines, Brazil, and India. And so I'll just kind of leave it here, and if any of you get Time magazine. And then also earlier this year, it might have even been up to 6 months ago, if you go to a library, I think that something, if you're just interested in not real heavy reading, there was a Time magazine with the issue, it was called The Debt Bomb. Did any of you see it? And basically, it was an interesting article in that it laid out the very tenuous situation that the international monetary system is in right now, and particularly the situation of the Third World nations. And I guess I just lay those things out as possible things for you to look into. And then
I think that's all I'll say now because maybe people have questions. And tomorrow, I mainly just go into more things that you can do in communities.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. Any comments or questions on the, you know, causes of hunger or some of the solutions, measures, whatever? Let, tell you, while we're doing this too, let me just, if you don't mind, just pass, this is propaganda.
Here, let me
maybe on that side, I'll start one off. If you just take one and pass the others around, that'd be fine. These are just descriptive folders on Bread for the World. Happen to have a little tear-out coupons for membership, so you know, you're always welcome to fill them out. So.
There was one question.
Now, there were a couple of hands here. And Jack, I think you had your hand.
You had raised the sort of intriguing comment that overpopulation is a consequence of hunger. Could you expand on that?
Yeah. Country like India does not have, you know, you ask why do people have a lot of kids? Country like India doesn't have Social Security the way we know it. Social Security basically means surviving sons. And where you've got, you know, high infant mortality rate in particular, you know, a peasant couple wanting to, you know, provide for its long-range future and make sure they have surviving sons, typically is going to have a big family. I mean, if you assume that they may get some girl children, maybe half of their kids are going to be female, maybe more than half, who knows, you know. And they have to worry that the sons they do have, some of them are very apt to die. So that adds up to large families. Now, I don't mean to suggest that's the only reason people have large families. They, you know, poor people often, I lived next, on the Lower East Side of New York and worked in an inner city parish for many years. There's a Spanish Puerto Rican family living right next to me. The father had 10 kids. It was a big family. And he once said, children is the one luxury a poor man can afford. I mean, he loved his kids. And so, you know, there are other reasons, but as a matter of fact, the economics of it does provide some incentive for people to have larger families. Now, when the evidence shows that once the population growth rate has begun to really soar, societies have not been able to bring that substantially downward, apart from the benefits of social and economic gains that are sufficiently spread among the masses of poor people as to give them some hope for improving their situation. And when that happens, then the growth rate does begin to come down. Now, family planning measures can be very helpful in that connection if they go along with those other things that are happening. But done in isolation, they're not very effective.
In the bookstore, last week there was a woman here by the name of Sister Maria Augustine O'Neill, and she is a sociologist, and she's been, she teaches in Boston, but has been doing a study at Harvard for the past 3 years, and she had some material that I hope is still in the bookstore about the population studies, and it's very current, 1983, and basically showing the population trends, and statistically, it just shows up so clearly that when the economic situations of nations become more stable, there's a dramatic lowering of the birth rate. And I found it very interesting to look at that. And it is, maybe they don't have it out anymore, but if you would ask in the bookstore, they do have that. And that was very interesting.
Yeah. Having said all that, it's also true that many of these countries need far more vigorous efforts in the way of family planning measures to bring that growth rate down. I mean, a lot of countries are really worried about it. China is certainly terribly worried. Vietnam is terribly worried. A lot of countries are. I was just in West Africa. Niger has a situation where a lot of land is being put into production that's too marginal. It shouldn't be. And over the long pull, the prediction is that's going to just turn into desert. but the pressure of the population and consequent political pressure is just pushing him in that direction. So, there was another hand here.
A comment that has a sort of question. It seems to me that if we put ourselves into a state of mind that says that that what we can do is limited, we don't say that when we produce the bombs that we're producing these days, the military, the expenditures. We don't say that about our American lifestyle, which is going higher and higher. I guess I just have a hard time when our aid to countries is in terms of what? $8 to $10 billion that we squeeze out of Congress, which is a fabulous amount of money, but is nothing in comparison to the money that we're going to spend for armaments.
Yeah.
That troubles me, I guess, as a Christian, it troubles me if somehow I live in a country and I say that what I can do is limited because I want to do all these other things. I guess I have a hard time understanding that. It's sort of like, to me, to use a different suggestion, in our country in the last couple of years, we have cut programs in food for children throughout this country for small children. I don't know about your school system, but free lunch is very less free in our country these days for kids.
Right.
And yet we're spending more money for unproductive kind of stuff. And we've allowed that in our country to happen. And many of us said we can't do anything about it. And I guess it just bothers me that I understand when we say, we can't save the world and all that sort of thing. That's not where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But I think our country has chosen, and we have allowed our political leaders to move in directions that what we can do to help anybody except for ourselves is going to continue to be limited.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the direction we're going to go,
mm-hmm.
If that's the direction, then I think we as Christians, we might as well opt out and say, forget it. I guess what I'm saying is that the system we are building is so counter to the gospel that maybe we as Christians would do better off, sort of like the South African investments. We just better off pull it all out, instead of playing a game with our government and saying that somehow what we are doing is helping people. We're helping a few, but the problem is getting bigger and bigger. I don't know. That's just a reaction. I guess. I have some. I just don't know. All the food that we have in this country, that we can't give it to children who are actually hungry in our own cities. And what's the purpose of that? Does that make them better because they don't have a breakfast in the morning? Obviously we all know it'll hurt their mind. We're producing problems for the future.
Sure.
I just don't see where our system is going, I guess, in terms of, instead of things getting better, it seems to me that they sort of get worse. That's a lot of different kinds of, even when we talk about it, you mentioned earlier, unemployment 10%. That's the government's figures. That's not real.
Right.
That's not honest figures. The figures are much higher than that. There are people who've given up a long time
sure.
of getting a job, and they're not going to get a job. And
they're not capped.
They're just, and we allow that to happen in our employment system. We allow it to go on. I say we because to some degree we have a responsibility,
sure.
or at least we have some input. So those are some things that trouble me about the hunger area here and our complicity, I guess, with the system that we're operating with.
Well,
how is your feeling about complicity?
Okay.
Maybe that's what I'm asking.
I'll get by. Jenny
is... I just want to react in one way is that last week I was really brought to a realization in Sister Marie's sessions, and that she made the comment that I think we as a nation have to begin to decide what we believe are basic rights of every person. And what that might look like is very frightening to some people, because if we begin to believe that it's a basic right for everyone to have food, which was the purpose of the Right to Food Resolution in 1976, and we seem to have forgotten about that, and if we believe that health care is a right of every person, and if we believe the right to work is a right for, you know, to be able to determine your own dignity through employment, then consequently our government might look a little different than it is. And why, how we define what that is maybe isn't so important. And it was a very new way for me to look at it, because a lot of people, a lot of red lights were going up for many people, because they were saying, but you're really advocating socialism. And she said, okay, well, let's get away from the term socialism, communism, capitalism, and let's more look at it from what do people need? What are needs, basic needs of people? But as you said, we seem to be not sure what we want, because it seems to be evident to me through what you're saying, this agonizing over seeing these things happen, and yet the trend is still in a very opposite direction. So are we as a people, as Americans, rather confused about what we really want? That's how I feel, that are we really sure? Because if we do make the decision to make these basic rights, like many nations have, then it's very likely our government will look different than it is at the present time. I don't know if that's correct.
I would agree with that. And I appreciate very much what you said, too. And I don't at all disagree with what you said. What I was, and I probably could have said what I did better, what I was really, I was starting out with a list of big causes of hunger. And then I was moving into some relatively dinky little pieces of legislation, you know. And when I look at the causes and how formidable they are, and look at the immediate pieces of legislation that Bread for the World is working on, I have to say, look, what we can do is very modest. We shouldn't imagine that, hey, if you get on the bandwagon and we get these bills passed, you know, then we're really going to be looking at the hunger problem. This is only a drop in the bucket, and we're just making some dents. Yeah, in fact, I think what we could do if we put our minds, if we had the political will and put our resources to it, would be enormously significant. We could be the leaders in turning the world around on the hunger issue, without a doubt. And it seems to me that is the challenge for Christians here in the United States.